I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be sober. I'm certainly grateful to be here with you. I want to thank ACUFA for giving me the invitation and offering me an opportunity to share a little bit about the steps in my life. The workshop is The Steps Come Alive for a reason. I brought my big book. This is just so you know I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It always gives people a sense of ease and comfort when they see the speaker carrying a book. Rarely, though, do they ever open it, but I like to bring it with me just so you feel comfortable in the room. Wayne did an excellent job last night of talking about the book. I'm not going to talk about the book. I'm not going to talk about the steps as they're written in the book, because you can read the book and do that. The steps come alive means that you take them out of the book, put them into your life, and you live them. So hopefully that's what I'm going to do a little bit this afternoon, to share with you a little bit about how the steps work in my life and how I make some effort to try and live the 12 steps. It's certainly okay. If you guys want to text during the meeting, please go ahead. Whenever they say don't text, I see all the phones being pulled out and you start texting. So if you want to text, that's fine with me. If you want to post on Facebook how incredible the speaker is, go ahead and do that as well. I need all the press I can get. My sobriety date is October 4th, 1975. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, not an alcoholic. I came to you with a driving problem. The state of California was starting to get concerned about people racing down the freeway at 80 miles an hour, blowing something in the breathalyzer above their grade point average. And they were starting to hand out some serious consequences. And in 1975, there was a court program. It's not around anymore, but there was a court program. It was a pre-conviction program. If you went through their program and successfully completed it, they took the drunk driving off of your record. And so my drinking history is pretty large, and I was being sentenced to some serious time, and the judge offered me this alternative. It was called Lucky Deuce, which I think is kind of bizarre now when I think about it, but he offered me the Lucky Deuce program, and I took it, and I came to you, and I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I listened to people talk, and this is what I heard. Wah, 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 wah. That's all I heard in the meetings. I don't know what you were saying. That's what I heard. Because I had no idea what alcoholism was. I wasn't an alcoholic. I had a driving problem. People were talking about, in hindsight, I suppose they were talking about the same things they talk about today. In 12-step meetings, they were talking about letting go and letting God. They were talking about surrendering to win. They were talking about the spiritual tools of recovery, and I was hearing wah, 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 wah. When I don't drink alcohol, I get restless, irritable, and discontent. When I don't drink alcohol, a volcano explodes inside of me, and I want to see blood. I prefer it's yours. And so I would get irritated easily in meetings of alcohol. Parker, I thought you were rapping. Oh, okay. You're going to video it, right? Okay, thanks. White boy rap at 2:30. And I wanted to be there, and I was trying to figure out how to be multiple personality disorder and get down there. So I would be in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this volcano would go off inside of me. And I always sat in the back. Not that there's anything wrong with being in the back. I hear people, hi, Charlotte. I hear people say things like, you know, if you want sobriety, you sit in the front of the room. Well, somebody's got to sit in the back. And I still sit in the back for this reason, to be an example of the fact that recovery does reach the back of the room. And it was reaching the back of the room in 1975 because this volcano would go off inside of me. I didn't know I was irritated. The volcano would go off, and I would jump up from the back of the room, and I think Keith was in some of those meetings. I would start screaming at the person talking. And I would scream. It was always all profanities, but I hung them together. It sounded like a sentence. And I would just blurt out this string of profanities from the back of the room. And then somebody who understood the traditions would turn around and smile at me and say, keep coming back. And I'd flip them off and I'd show them my court card and tell them I didn't have a choice, and I'd sit back down until the volcano went off again. And then sometimes I would throw a chair at you. Sometimes they used to put coffee pots on the tables, and at the Canyon Club in Laguna, I'd fling those across the room. Carried a knife in my boot. I would throw it at the literature rack. Always aimed at the piece of literature a member's eye view. I didn't always hit it, but that's what I aimed at. And the volcano was going off, and the volcano was going off, and the volcano was going off. And people just kept telling me to keep coming back. To another meeting, please, but keep coming back. And they never threw me away, and they never told me I couldn't be here. And they never told me I had to be an alcoholic. And I'm so eternally grateful for that, because if you had told me I had to be an alcoholic to be in your rooms, I wouldn't be here this afternoon. What you did for me is you did what it says to do in that book. You did for me, you brought the 12 steps alive in your life, and you practiced the 12 steps of recovery in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and in between meetings. And what you did is you shared your alcoholism with me. So I'm going to share my alcoholism with you this afternoon, in the hopes that what happened to me will happen to somebody in this room. Because I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for 8.5 months while you shared about your alcoholism, and your alcoholism touched mine. And your alcoholism touched mine, and your alcoholism touched mine, and your alcoholism touched mine. And your alcoholism touched mine for 8.5 months in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You shared the way the book says to share. You talked about what it used to be like. Every once in a while, I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the speaker will say something like this. They'll say, well, I'm not going to talk about what it used to be like because we all know how to drink. When I hear that, I get frightened. Because if you're not talking about what it used to be like, if you're not sharing your alcoholism, there's nothing going to happen in this room that's going to touch my alcoholism. And if you don't share my alcoholism, when I'm new, my alcoholism can't wake up. And when I'm 37 years sober, my alcoholism will fall back to sleep. I have to hear people share about what it used to be like so that your alcoholism can continue to touch mine and I can stay awake in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first step of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous says we admitted we were alcoholics, and the book says this is the first step of recovery. How do I admit that I'm alcoholic? How do I know that I'm alcoholic? I see people in AA all the time raise their hand and say, Mary, alcoholic, Bill, alcoholic, John, alcoholic, and they have absolutely no idea what they're claiming because their alcoholism hasn't woken up. And then they're gone, and then they're back. Mary, alcoholic, Sam, alcoholic. And nobody's woken up their alcoholism. They haven't listened to people share what it used to be like to have their alcoholism wake up. I had my first drink of alcohol when I was 13 years old. I'm sorry I waited that long, but I didn't know what alcohol would do to me or for me. I don't remember ever thinking much about alcohol. And yet when I was 13 years old, I took a drink. I was on a camping trip. I drank a quart of vodka. Nothing happened to me for about 15 minutes, and I had to go to the bathroom, and that's the only thing that happened to me. I went to the bathroom. I was at the beach camping, went out to the outhouse and went to the bathroom. And when I got done and went to get up, I realized I was paralyzed to the toilet seat. And I couldn't breathe. I couldn't blink. I couldn't move. And I was overcome with a sense of fear. And that fear was to stay with me long into my sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was overcome with a sense of fear. And the fear was that somebody else is going to have to come use that outhouse. And there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. And later found out two people can use the same toilet at the same time if the second person is very careful about what they're doing. But I know it's a visual, right? But I didn't know that at 13. I did somehow figure that the body was made up of energy, and I somehow figured if I could gather my energy, I'd be all right. So I've always referred to it as my first formal meditation because I sat and I gathered my energy. And when it seemed to be in one place, when it seemed to be centrally located, I just sort of fell off the toilet, out the door, into the sand, and started crawling back to the tent. Now, when I got here, you explained to me my entire problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have had a fantasy as in the Marines, as being dive-bombed as I was trying to get back to safety. And if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. In my own defense, I always have to tell you, my pants were still down at my ankles. I'd started to get sick. I couldn't quite get through it. I couldn't get around it. And I've always contended under those circumstances it's a little difficult to have a good attitude. I did somehow manage to get back to the tent. I fell in and I passed out. And when I came to in the morning, I realized nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure out where they went. So my eyes cleared enough that I realized I'd been sick all night long. I'd hit the top of the tent, the side of the tent, the floor of the tent. I hadn't missed a square inch. And I didn't want to be in the tent either, so I got out of there. And that was my first drink of alcohol. It was the most amazing, wonderful, incredible, marvelous, magnificent, fabulous spiritual experience I'd ever had. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body from that day until the day I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always get drunk, and I didn't always drink the kinds of things that you would classify as a beverage. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. I used to buy it by the six-pack. Some of you are awfully young. They might not. They don't put alcohol in it anymore. They used to put alcohol in vanilla extract. I think not putting it in there is kind of a rip-off for our children, but I used to drink that by the six-pack. I used to drink a lot. I drank a lot of mouthwash. I drank a lot of perfume. Taboo became my... Who said ick? I mean, gin didn't taste that good either, you know, really. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. I still have a problem with Taboo. If you're wearing it, I may follow you too closely and laugh at your neck. But what fascinates me is that alcoholics, we know stuff. You know, my next-door neighbors who are not alcoholic, they've been to my house a few times. They've never once eaten or drank a single thing out of my bathroom. But alcoholics, we know that stuff. We know stuff that other people don't know. And we don't know that it's unusual. I didn't know it was unusual. I was a bar drinker. I was a living room drinker, an alley drinker, a car drinker, a dumpster drinker, an office drinker. I didn't specialize, I just drank. But I love bars. I love sleazy, nasty, disgusting bars. Yeah, there's a couple in Fresno, too, aren't there? I'll tell you what, I drove up here from Orange County this morning. It was a pretty grueling drive, but the last 50 miles, y'all need to do something about that. Last 50 miles into town, finally I see this big billboard. It said, guns, next exit. It like woke me up, but there's some sleazy bars in Fresno. There are those ones with sawdust on the floor. Mirrors are cracked where people have tried to dip around to see themselves as they're looking in there. The poster on the bar is ripped. They used to be full of smoke. I understand you can't smoke in a bar anymore in California, which it makes no sense to me. I drank in bars where guys would take a piss against the wall, and apparently they can still do that, but they can't drink in there, or they can't smoke in there. But what fascinates me is the quality of people who drank in those bars. I mean, there were CEOs of big companies, admirals in the Air Force, neurosurgeons. I mean, we never told a lie in a bar, didn't we? But we weren't having conversations like, well, what do you prefer, the red mouthwash or the green? What's your preference, Chantilly or Aqua Velva? We weren't having those kinds of conversations. So it doesn't occur to me I'm living any different than anybody else. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. I don't know that at 13 years old I put alcohol into an alcoholic body, and from that day on I had no choice. I think I drink because I want to drink. I had an opportunity to go to college. I graduated college with a 3.8 grade point average. I left college. I went into the profession of my choice. I rose very quickly to the top. And both of those things almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I got to you, I told you I was too smart and too successful to be an alcoholic. I told you about the trophies and the plaques I had won. I told you about the awards. I didn't tell you. I was in the newspaper business. I didn't tell you about the times I would come out of a blackout behind a podium much like this in a room full of people holding an award, not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And so I would say thank you, and I would go sit down, and then Johnny would elbow me and say you were presenting it to the Kiwanis Club, and I'd have to get up and start over again. And I didn't tell you that. I just told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. And the only thing I wanted to do since I was in the fourth grade was be a writer. I had an opportunity to do that. I gave it up for one more drink. If it came between anything and a drink, I took a drink. A job and a drink, I took a drink. You and a drink, I took a drink. A family and a drink, I took a drink. Anything and a drink, I took a drink. And yet I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. 12 drunk driving assault charges. I end up in Alcoholics Anonymous. Absolutely no idea that I'm an alcoholic. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. I sit in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I listen to you talk about your story. And I just told you a little bit of my story. And that little bit of my story, every time you told your story, it touched something in me. Every time you talked about taking a drink and not being able to predict what you were going to do, it touched something in me, and it touched something in me, and it touched something in me. And 8.5 months in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, not drinking and not recovering, my disease woke up here in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. My first step happened in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My first step could not have happened for me. rationalization, justification, and denial. I'd read the book. I'd read the book several times. In my first meeting, they told me the answers were in this book. So I stole it, because God knows I need to have the answers. I read the book the first night. I couldn't find the answers, and I couldn't find the questions. Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, I went to my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous to get the answer book, because I figured there must be another book. I went to get the answer book. I asked him which was the answer book. The guy pointed to it. I stole another one. And I've been getting books ever since looking for the answers. I've read that book. In the first 8.5 months, I read it probably, not exaggerating, I probably read it 20 times looking for the answers. I could not find my alcoholism in that book. I found my alcoholism in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous because you shared your story with me. And 8.5 months away from my last drink, my alcoholism woke up. If you're working with somebody who's having difficulty, sit them in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous where the people in the meeting understand that it's about sharing what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. Because my alcoholism woke up. I've been in pain in the last 37 years. Sometimes life is painful, not just for alcoholics, but people. Sometimes life is painful. I've never been in the kind of pain that I was in 8.5 months away from my last drink. The pain of not drinking and not recovering. The pain of not drinking and not recovering drove me to my knees. And on my knees, I admitted to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. My disease woke up. Parker, good luck. I hope you win. Do you get a trophy?
Yeah, I'll give it to you.
Okay, thank you. Be my first rap trophy. My disease woke up, and I took the first step of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. I admitted to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. The second step says, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I hear people in AA have big discussions all the time about God. Big debates about God, what God is, who God is, what God isn't, what God, who God is, what God is, who God isn't, what God isn't. I hear big debates about God in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't think, for me, the second step doesn't have anything to do with who or what God is. The step says, simply says, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I take exception with the fact that that means that you think I'm insane. But here's the thing for me. Do you ever hear us tell newcomers don't think? I don't know how you do that. I think all the time. I'm talking to you, I'm thinking about something else. And I start thinking about what I'm thinking. Then I start thinking I shouldn't be thinking what I'm thinking while I'm thinking what I shouldn't be thinking. And I'm glad I don't have a loudspeaker on my head, so that everything I thought came barreling out. I mean, that would be truly humiliating, but I think all the time. And I have alcoholism. I don't have alcoholism. I have alcoholism. I hear people say things like, I haven't thought about drinking since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I think about drinking all the time because I have alcoholism. I don't have alcoholism. But what happened for me is through a series of actions, I can have a thought and I don't have to take an action on it. I think that's the insanity of my disease. The insanity of my disease goes like this. I'm driving down the road. The light comes on behind me. I pull over. The officer walks up. I slam my car door open. My intent is just to knock him in the private parts, but men are a little fussy about their private parts. So as the door's flying open, he jumps back to protect himself. And when he jumps back, for me it's really a good thing because now he's far enough away that I can get him in focus. And I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me. I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try, and I go for him. And it'd be a really good fight for a couple of minutes, but I wouldn't remember that back at the car he had a friend. And the friend had a radio, and the friend would call some more friends. And pretty soon, it'd be three or four of them, one of me. It's not fair anymore. I'd say, uncle, and they'd take me away. And the next time the light comes on behind me, I pull over. The officer walks up. I slam my car door open. He jumps back to protect himself. He gets far enough away and get him in focus, and I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try and I'd go for him. Good fight for a couple of minutes, but I wouldn't remember the friend, the radio, and the friend's friend. And pretty soon it'd be four or five of them, one of me. It's not fair anymore. It's my uncle, and they take me away. I didn't do that once or twice. I did that 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times. I never remembered the friend, the radio, and the friend's friend. And when you get out of a car like that, they attach an assault charge. They don't even care that they won the fight. Drunk driving assault. Drunk driving assault. And that's the insanity of my disease. The insanity of my disease is I do the same thing over and over, and I think the results are going to be different. Sometimes this time it's a fair fight. This time it's going to be different. And what I came to believe in step two, I came to believe that you were telling me the truth. You talked about what it was like for you today. You talked about living life without taking a drink. You talked about going to work and your boss getting upset with you and you didn't deck him. You talked about having something happen to you and you didn't drink. And I never knew that. I always drank. I always drank. And so I came to believe that you were telling me the truth, that I could live this life. I could live it differently than I've been living it. And all I need to do is do what you said you had done. So the step two for me was not a big, trauma about God. It was simply coming to believe that the people in AA were telling me the truth. And it's easier to believe that you're telling me the truth when my disease has come awake sitting amongst you. I can believe that you're telling me the truth when you've told me your story. If you've told me, when I heard Keith's story and I saw him living a life as a decent human being, I came to believe that he was telling me the truth, that this thing, somehow this was going to work because it worked for you. So I came to believe the people in AA were telling me the truth. Step three says, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. I make probably 100 decisions a day. I'm good at making decisions. I make decisions fast. What I have trouble with is taking an action to implement the decision. That'll give me some grief sometime. But I have spent my whole life trying to think my way into right living, and that's never worked for me. So step three, I came to understand that it was about acting my way into right thinking. I make a decision. I was driving here today, and I'm driving up the road, and now with my smartphone, I have this little lady says to me, at exit 41, turn right. Well, I already told you I have alcoholism. I don't have alcoholism. So exit 41 comes, and I think, no, I don't want to get off on exit 41. I want to see what's at exit 42. So I keep going. And she doesn't say, Patio, you're a lousy driver. Pull over. She just kind of reconfigures my route for me. And then she'll say, at exit 43, turn left. Well, exit 43 comes, and I make a decision to turn left because I figure, okay, I don't want her annoyed with me. I make it a decision to turn left, but I keep going straight, and I miss the exit. So she reconfigures again. She doesn't say, Patty, oh, you're a lousy, but really, pull over and walk the rest of the way. She just reconfigures it again, and I make a U-turn, and I'm back going down, and she'll say, okay, now at exit 42, turn right. Well, I make a decision to turn right, because I'm going to do what she says to do. I make a decision to turn right. You ever done this with your sponsor? I make a decision to do what she said to do. But then I just keep going, because like a crow flies by and I see something shiny. And I just keep going. And I make a U-turn and I go back and I make a decision. And I go by it and I make a U-turn and go back. I'm making good decisions. I'm making a decision to do what she's telling me to do. But until I take the steering wheel and do this and take an action, nothing's going to happen. I'm never going to get here. I'm going to be U-turning up that 99 freeway for the rest of my life, which probably isn't going to be that long. I'm just U-turning, U-turning, and U-turning. The decision is easy. I've got all the resources I need to make the healthiest decisions in the world. I have the best sponsor ever. And she gives me really good suggestions. She shares with me really good experience. And I make a decision, by golly, because I want what she has. I make a decision. I'm doing what she did. But then the crow flies by, or some good-looking boy walks by, or something happens that just looks so much more exciting than that. And I just keep going. It's not about the decision. It's about the action. The third step says simply make a decision. Make a decision to do what the people in AA have said they've done. Make a decision. The action, the book very nicely, which I said I wasn't going to quote, so I won't, I'll misquote it. The book very nicely says, although our decision was vital, it had very little permanent effect unless immediately followed by action. Well, thank you, but I prefer just to make decisions. Especially when the action is the fourth step. That writing that fourth step, writing that inventory, I'm a trained writer. I'm thinking, you know what, I've college educated writer. I really don't need to write an inventory. I know all the creative writing skills I need. I'm really not interested in doing an inventory. And I didn't do it. And I'm here to tell you, you can sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and be miserable for a very, very long time without doing the inventory, without doing the fourth step. You can sit here a long, long time and not do it. What happened for me, though, is I thought this was Mary's meeting. I thought this was Johnny's program. I referred to Alcoholics Anonymous as my sponsor's thing. It wasn't mine. I hadn't done anything. I made an admission. I came to believe, and I made a decision. I've done nothing else. I was just a guest in Alcoholics Anonymous. By the grace of a gentle and loving God, I didn't drink. But it wasn't my program. I was just a guest here. Growing up, my perception growing up, and it's only my perception, but it's true. Growing up, people hurt me all my life. They hurt me and they disappointed me. They let me down. They told me they loved me anymore. Their love and I had died. Their love was physically, emotionally, and spiritually abusive. I made a decision as a small child that I didn't want to be hurt anymore. And when you make a decision like that, you've got to protect yourself. And so I built a brick wall to keep you out because I don't want to be hurt anymore. What I didn't know about that brick wall is it made me a prisoner inside. I lived behind that brick wall in isolation and loneliness. And when you live behind a wall like that, alcohol doesn't allow you to come out and play. Alcohol just makes it okay for you to be back there. And when you live behind a wall like that, you don't believe and you don't trust. And I hadn't believed a human being in a long time, and I certainly didn't trust. And I lived behind that wall. And what I can tell you today is that that wall was made up of all the things that I was to discover in my fourth step. And without doing a fourth step, there's no way to come out from behind that wall. There's no way to get out. The men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous, you would come by and you'd take a brick out and you'd whisper something into me, but I'd get scared and I'd put another brick in. And you'd come by and take another brick out and you'd whisper something to me and I'd get scared and I'd put another brick in. And you take my sponsor would take two or three out because she's really very good at it. And she'd tell me something and I'd put more bricks up because I'm too afraid. I'm too afraid. I've got to have that wall. I can't be amongst you. And so I lived behind that wall for weeks and months and years in Alcoholics Anonymous. By grace of a loving God, I didn't take a drink. And I finally became willing. I looked at the fourth step, and I became willing to do what it asked me to do. I wrote about my resentments, which basically turned out to be everybody who breathed air that I thought should have been mine. I made a list of people who I resented, and resentment for me was, if I thought about what you did to me in the second grade, pretty sure it's a resentment. If I thought about what you did to me in my first job, pretty sure it's a resentment. If I could remember your name, pretty sure it was a resentment. I resented most everybody in my life for the simple reason you didn't do what I wanted you to do. You didn't do it my way. You didn't do what I wanted. You did something different. And so I made a list of the people I resented, which really turned out to be kind of fun. I mean, I don't know your experience, but once I got started on it, it was really fun. And there were a couple people that I did, their name just fell out on my, I thought, oh my God, I haven't thought about it. That little prick, and I just start writing it. I don't even know why I forgot about him, the little jerk. And I was having a really good time. I made the list. I was kind of sorry I'd waited this long to do it because it was kind of fun. And then I wrote in the next column what they did to me. Well, I wanted to tell you all my life what they did to me. And nobody wanted to hear about it. Now I'm really kind of excited because somebody wants to hear what they did to me. And I wrote about what they did to me, and I wrote about how it affected me, and I really felt kind of good about it and called my sponsor and told her I was done. And she said, well, what did you have to do with any of it? I said, what do you mean, what did I have to do with any of it? She said, Well, what did you do? How did you set it up? What did you do to make that happen? What did you do to have that be a part of your life? How did you embrace that? I said, why are you my sponsor? I was like, I need somebody with a little empathy. What do you mean? What was? Okay, the steps are coming way too alive here for me. I'm kind of take the fire right out of this whole thing. But I had to start looking at how I set it up. The book talks about that we set it in motion. I set it in motion. How did I set it up? What was I looking for? What was my expectation? What did I expect from you that you disappointed me? You couldn't disappoint me if I didn't have expectations. What was my what my side of the street look like? Where had I been at fault? And it was selfishness, it was self-centeredness, it was all pretty much the same. There were no new tricks in there. There were no new ponies. And I began to look at how I had set in motion the people in my life that I had resentments for. And the book talks, as several times it mentions old ideas. And for the first time, I started to get clear on where my old ideas came from. My old ideas came from my perceptions of you. My old ideas came from my perceptions that I listed in my resentments. It wasn't just about a litany of people who had let me down. It began to look like a list of perceptions that I had about my life. For example, I work with a woman who was telling me one time about she resented her mother because her mother sent her away. This is really, I'm making this up. I'm not making it up. I'll just tell you the truth. My son. It's my son's story. One of his resentments against me was that I sent him away every summer. And that resentment of me sending him away every summer affected his life in our relationship. It affected choices he'd made in his life in terms of our relationship. It affected things in his life in terms of how behaviors he had that affected me. But his perception is that you sent me away all of my life. Every summer you sent me away. Here's the truth. The sober person knows the truth. The truth is, I was a single parent. I thought for some reason my old idea was that summer camp is really important for children. And that was my old idea because I never got to go to summer camp. All of my little friends went to summer camp. And they'd come back after summer camp and talk about wonderful how much fun they had. And I always felt bad because I never got to go to summer camp. So one of my resentments with my parents was, you never sent me to summer camp. Never occurred to me there were seven kids. My father's an alcoholic. He drank most of the money. My mother didn't work, and rarely was there food. My focus is on, you didn't send me to summer camp. And all my friends had a really good time. So I decide as a parent, I'm sending my child to summer camp. And I'm a single parent. So every payday, I sacrificed, I went without, I put money aside. Every payday, I put a little money aside, every payday, so I had enough money to send him to YMCA camp in the summertime. My perception is I sacrificed all of my life to send you, little bastard. To send you to summer camp based on my old idea that my parents didn't love me because they didn't send me. So it's this trickle down of all. Now he's got this old idea that you sent me away that he's acting on, and God knows what he's going to do to his child with that, except for that he has a mother who is incredibly powerful and wonderful who will save her child from my son. Hi, Lindy Pierce. So this, my old ideas trickle to his old ideas, go to somebody else's old ideas. And the impact is like this phenomena impact. And it gets to stop with us. It gets to stop here. If I do the work and I look at the work and I see how I set it in motion and I uncover my old idea doesn't have to be an idea anymore. I hope that my son, when he decides that his son needs to go to summer camp, will say to the child, would you like to go to summer camp? Do you think it would be fun to go? Do you want to go to church camp or YMCA camp? And let him have a voice in the decision so that when he's 30 years old, he's not making decisions based on an old idea. And he doesn't have to do four-step columns to get to it. So I did the columns and I started looking at where my old ideas came from. All of them, selfish and self-centered. All of my old ideas stem from resentments that I have for people in my life who did or didn't do what I expected or wanted from them. And that's the power of that step. And I can't find it in here. I can only find it by taking the action of doing it. I can only find it by taking an action of writing about it. An action that seems to me to be ludicrous, silly, and have no, who cares? Who cares is what it seems to me. And I made the columns and I made the list and I looked at it and I started to uncover my old ideas. And then I wrote about my fears. The book talks about fear is an evil and corroding thread. The fiber of our existence is shot through with it, which indicates we have more than a little bit of fear. A lot of fear. I got a lot of fear going on. And alcoholics, we're not the only people who have fear, but we have such an abundance of it. They ought to rename it alcoholic fear. We have such an abundance of fear. And I think my fear, when I started writing my fears sort of stem from the same place. They stem from the place that I don't like to feel. I have a feeling coming up. Whoa, no feeling. Drink, 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 drink. I suspect there's a feeling around the corner. Oh, no, no, no. Drink, 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 drink. You're having a feeling. Whoa, drink, 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 drink. I'm not a feeling. I can't handle my alcoholism. I cannot handle feelings. Good ones, no matter how I judge them all as I don't want it. I judge them all as I don't want a feeling. I can't handle feelings. Drink, 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 drink. So now the fear, if I look at my fears, realistically look at my fears, put them on paper and look at them and make them real to me, all of them stem from there's a feeling coming up there. There's some feeling underneath it. Simple, I'm afraid of snakes. Feeling, fear, there's a feeling underneath it. Every one of my fears is a feeling underneath it that I don't want to face. I want to drink instead. So I write down my fears and I look at them, bring them out into the sunlight of the spirit, if you will, and look at them and see that most of them really aren't boogeymen. Now, there's some things I should be fearful of. I should be fearful of walking the tightrope from the across a building, 16-story buildings. I should be fearful of doing that, and so I don't do it. There are some fears that are realistic. But 99% of my fears simply based on a feeling that was coming in that I didn't want to experience. My relationships... It says sex, but I think for me it goes beyond just sex into relationships with everybody. I began to look at my relationships with you because all of them were selfish and self-centered. All of them were self-serving. All of them were about what could I get from me. When it asked me to look at where I'd been selfish or self-centered, every relationship I'd had was selfish and self-centered. I had absolutely no idea how to be a partner. I had no idea how to be a people amongst people. I had no idea how to be one of you. I certainly had no idea of how to be of service. And I think in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think that we give each other grand opportunities to learn how to do relationships in a healthy way. We give each other grand opportunities by simple things, like have a commitment, by being on a committee, by going to H&I, by taking a panel to detox, by being a person in a group of people who is just a person in a group of people. We give each other absolute incredible opportunities to have relationships that are healthier than anything that I've ever had. And so I began to look at my relationships with people and to see where I had been selfish and self-centered. And not only to look at where I'd been selfish and self-centered, but possibly to take a look at where I could do it differently. And I don't know how. I absolutely don't know how. And so I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you share how to do it differently. And you allow me to take that experience in the world and live it. And you give me an opportunity. When one of the, I think probably the best commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous is coffee maker. Certainly the most important. And I know that because I was coffee maker of my Monday. The first commitment they gave me was coffee maker of my step study meeting. And after the meeting, they gave me the big coffee pot to take home and the big can of coffee, and I brought it the next week, and I filled up the coffee pot with water, and I opened the can, and I poured the whole can into the little basket of the coffee pot, put the top on and plugged it in, and it kind of took a long time to start perking, but it finally started perking, and some guy came to the meeting, and he poured himself a cup of coffee, took a big old jolt off of that, and his eyeballs rolled back into his head. The next guy took a cup and his eyeballs rolled back, and somebody else took some and their eyeballs. And pretty soon people were just taking half a cup and sipping it. They weren't. But nobody said who made this swill. Nobody said who made this. Nobody complained. They just sipped. And after the meeting, the secretary said, well, we had a steering committee and we realized how important coffee maker was. It's so important, we're giving Patty an assistant. And they gave me an assistant. And the next week, my assistant and I showed up and filled up the coffee, and he opened the can and he measured it into the little basket. And he didn't tell me what to do. He showed me what to do. And that's the kind of relationship that the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous have been showing me now for 37 years. And that's the kind of relationship, when I did my list of relationships in my fourth step, that's the kind of relationship I had absolutely no idea about. I had no idea of how to show somebody what to do. I had an idea of how to boss you and how to control you and how to be bossed and how to be controlled, but I had no idea of how to show you what to do. In Alcoholics Anonymous, when you admitted you were powerless and your life was unmanageable, you have never tried to, well, some of you have tried to manage mine, but it hasn't worked. You've never tried to manage, always showing me what to do. And that's the kind of relationship that I uncovered in my fourth step that was absolutely out of my reach. I had absolutely no idea what that was. But I had to look at what the unhealthiness was. I had to look at where my relationships had gone wrong before I could ever do anything right. When I did my fourth step, I was overcome with a sense of belonging in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was overcome with the sense of that I was indeed one of you. I'm hearing you talk about your stories. I'm hearing you share with one another. And suddenly, when I've got it on black and white, I realize that we are all exactly the same. There's nothing different between me and you. We all have exactly the same story. We may have acted it out a little bit differently, but we all have exactly the same story. There is no way that we can get to the center, the core of our issues, with looking at three simple ideas unless we are absolutely exactly the same. And then I looked at the fifth step, and I thought, you know, I know about this stuff now intimately. I've just written about it. God knows about it, because my understanding of God is God knows everything. Two out of three really is not bad. I'm not kind of willing to settle for that. I'm not big on sharing this with anybody else. I was raised Catholic. I'm recovering nicely from that, but and I don't have an issue with the Catholic Church. It wasn't the Catholic Church. It was not what you said. It's always been how I've heard it. I heard the nuns say I was going to burn for just as long for thinking it as I was for doing it, and I've always been kind of an into action person, so I figure if I'm going to have the thought, I'm going to take an action. And so I did a lot of stuff that I should never have, I had no business doing, but I had the thought, so I took the action. And but I, being raised Catholic, we know about confession, and we know it doesn't work. And I've been to confession all my life, and it's there's really no point to it. So I probably don't have to do a fifth step. Probably the fifth step is for those of you who aren't Catholic. You can do a fifth step and then find out what we, the Catholics, already know. And rationalization, justification, and denial. My disease will make me different from you at every turn. At 37 years sober today, my disease can make me different than you if I don't stay in the middle of you. Rationalization, justification, and denial. If you, this is for you non-Catholics, you need to do this fifth step thing. So I didn't need to do it. And I put my fourth step in the trunk of my car. I live alone. My son was about, it took a long time for me to recover. He was about five, I think. I know he didn't read yet, but I didn't want anybody to find my fourth step. So I put it in the trunk of my car and I drove around with it for a really long time. And I drove around with a continual sense of impending doom. And the fear was that I'd be rear-ended on the freeway, my trunk would fly open, my fourth step would be everywhere. But rather than do a fifth step, I just chose to drive that way for a long time. And the pain of not drinking and not recovering set in again. I suddenly was found myself being angrier leaving meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous than I'd been when I went in. I heard people talk about, no matter how bad my day is, I go to a meeting, come into the room, listen for an hour and a half, and leave feeling so much better. And no matter how good my day was, I'd come into the room, listen to you share, and leave madder than I was when I came in. I'd leave angrier than I was when I came in. I'd be restlesser than I was when I came in. I'd be pissed off. And pretty soon I was like, I can't stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am too angry, to say, this isn't working for me. If you find yourself restless, irritable, and discontent in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, my suggestion is look at what you're holding on to. Because I was holding on to a lot of stuff. I was holding on to a four-step, and I wasn't holding on. Here's what I would do. Do they make cars with radiators in them anymore? Okay. Because I used to tell this story, and one day I said radiator, and this guy's eyes glazed over like he didn't know what I was talking about. So, but you know how when you're driving your car, if your radiator heats up, it's the thing that you put water in. If your radiator heats up, you can pull over the side of the road, open the cap, let a little steam out, then you can drive for a few more miles. And then it overheats again and steams up, and then you pull over and you let the cap off, you can drive for a few more miles. That's what I was doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would come here, sit in a meeting, dump a little bit, and I hear people talk, I want to come to the meeting to dump. Dump a little bit, get a little garbage out, not sharing what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like now. Certainly not sharing experience, strength, and hope, but dumping a little bit. It'd be like letting the cap off of that radiator. It could go a few more days. Then it'd build up again, and then I'd have to come in and dump a little more, let the cap off, drive a little bit. Well, like the radiator, pretty soon the radiator, you can't keep releasing it. You got to pretty soon take it into the radiator shop, get it drained out, get it repaired, and fill it back up. And that's the place I was in that day when I left. I was on my way out. I said, I can't stay here anymore. I'm in so much pain. This isn't working for me. I got to leave. And an old-timer, and thank God they can tell, they can read it in your eyes. This guy grabbed me on the way out. He said, where are you going? I said, Joe, I can't stay here. I can't stay in this pain. I'm miserable in Alcoholics. The rest of you are fine. The rest of you are good. I'm miserable. He said, Patty, before you leave, he said, try doing the fifth step. And I hadn't told anybody I hadn't done it. I mean, I thought, okay, my sponsor's now ratting me out again. But I hadn't told anybody, but we know. We know. And if I called, then I wanted to do it with somebody who didn't speak English. And or a deaf mute would have been good. But I asked this lady to listen to my fifth step. It wasn't my sponsor. I think God will put the person in front of us with whom we're to share. Because this wasn't my sponsor. But I was in so much pain at that moment, I asked her. And God had put her in front of me. Because I did my fourth step. I did my fifth step with her. I had it in the trunk of my car. I did my fifth step with her. And when I got done, she looked at me and she said, Patty, one day the things that you have listed as your greatest assets will become your greatest liabilities. And the things that you believe are your greatest liabilities in Alcoholics Anonymous will become your greatest assets. I wondered, just done a fifth step with a woman who's lost her last wing nut. It made absolutely no sense to me. I can tell you this afternoon, the things I have always thought were my greatest weaknesses in Alcoholics Anonymous become my greatest strengths. I'm a strong woman. I've always been a strong woman. That if for strong women, I suppose for strong men, I've just never met one to confirm this with, but you know, you pray before you do this, God just kind of works through you. I don't know. But if you're a strong person, it's very difficult to ask for help. If you're a strong person, you don't need help. I don't need you or they or them. I can do it myself. If I can't do it, it doesn't need to get done. Whenever I try to do anything by myself in Alcoholics Anonymous, I shortchange myself. Whenever I ask one of you to take my hand and walk with me, you open new doors and you add to my life. And the thing that I always thought was an asset, that strength, becomes a liability for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm happy to report that has happened in every area of my life. The things that I thought were my greatest weaknesses here become my greatest strengths. The things that I thought were most disgusting and most pathetic here are the greatest gifts that I have to share with somebody else. And I left that woman's house with a sense of belonging in Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that I belonged here. I knew that there was no place else for me except for the center, about in the very absolute middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And with that, we're going to take a brief break, long enough for those of you who smoke to go do that and come back. If we can be back in about 10 minutes, I'd appreciate it. If you have any questions, please write them on those little index cards and put them up here, and we'll answer them when we start up in 10 minutes. Thank you.